Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by economist Colm McCarthy. Colm, you're welcome and thanks for joining us.
How you doing?
Now, it's 20 years since the launch of the Euro project, and you're delivering a paper to the Dublin Economics Workshop this week, marking that 20th anniversary. It's your contention, Colm, if I read it correctly, that the euro is a flawed project and was from the start.
Well, it hasn't worked out terribly well if you take it on its own prospectus, which is this was a good idea for the European economy. We'd all have the same currency. You won't have to pay commission when you're moving around. Business firms will have more transparency about prices because they'll all be in the same money. And it was kind of sold as a logical completion of the integration of the European economy. It didn't work out well. It was fine for a while, but it did transpire that certain economies got into serious trouble, and the constraint of having the same currency narrowed their freedom of action in dealing with it. And it's not just countries like Ireland. You know, we, in my opinion, got very badly treated by the ECB during the financial crisis. You'll remember Monsieur Trichet and the imposition of payouts to unguaranteed bondholders and banks that had gone bust.
That explosions might go off if we didn't.
Indeed. But there were also grave difficulties for some of the southern European countries, where there had been some economic mismanagement, but they had lost the capacity to weaken their currencies. If you have your independent currency and you're not doing things all that well, well, you can sink the currency a bit and give yourself a bit of breathing space. You can't keep doing it, but Italy, for example, did it quite a lot, and so on. So there was a loss of some of the instruments of economic policy for all the countries that joined it. Kind of a lack of political legitimacy about the actions of the ECB. You know, the ECB ended up in conflict with the government of Greece, with the government of Cyprus, and actually with the government even of Spain, the government of Italy, and for sure with the government of Ireland. Now, that is a strange thing. You know, there's a central bank. You don't end up with the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, which is the U.S. central bank. You don't end up with the Federal Reserve picking a row with the government of Texas this week and with the government of Massachusetts next week. It doesn't work like that. So it's my belief that the project was a political project at the beginning, explicitly designed to hasten political union in Europe and so on. But it just got too far ahead of itself, and it has resulted in a political fracturing in Europe, a lot of antagonism to the European project, and now Brexit, which I think partly arose from the exclusion of the United Kingdom from the inner councils when the British decided not to join the euro.
We'll come back to that in a moment, but when you say it was a project that got ahead of itself, effectively greater European unity was one of the principal reasons it was launched. Does that mean, on the one hand, that there wasn't sufficient thought and planning given to the actual financial structures, cross-border financial structures, yeah, that would be required to support a common currency, and two, that perhaps the wrong countries joined from the start?
Well, I think both of those, really. But there's been this kind of great success story in Europe. I think overall, the completion of the internal market, the customs union, and in the 1990s, the single market, has created in Europe something that makes perfect sense, a barrier-free trade zone, which is really great for the smaller countries like us. But to have gone ahead and say, well, on top of that, we'll have a single currency, kind of presupposed a greater degree of federation than had actually been achieved. And Europe is not a federal state. It's a kind of a confederation of closely cooperating, but nonetheless independent sovereign states.
We know that now, Colin, but wasn't it the case in the 1990s when the Euro project really started gaining momentum under the likes of Jacques Delors that there was huge momentum towards a type of federal state at that stage? There's been rollback since.
Yeah, the trouble is to make the common currency, which is what it is and what it should be called, into a monetary union required a bit more political structure than was there or than has since proven possible. So I just don't think that electorates around Europe are prepared to see their domestic governments and parliaments reduced in status a bit and more powers going off to the centre, or not yet. In the case of the Brits, they've decided to clear off. And I think the euro currency thing, it was just premature. It was cart before the horse stuff. Let's have a single currency, pretend we have a full-going monetary union, pretend that everybody is in it, even though several countries declined to join, and we'll push ahead, and then political reality will catch up afterwards.
And its credibility probably questionable from the start with a big, constantly in trouble economy like Italy in there, and then joined by Greece 2 years later?
Well, there is a kind of a revisionist history of the euro underway. The people who are in charge of it, the ECB, have to keep saying this is terrific and it's all working out fine and we will deal with whatever emergencies arise. But there's a kind of a revisionist history being written, and one strand of it says, actually, if it had been smaller, if it had been just France, Germany, and maybe the Netherlands, Benelux countries, and one or two others, it might have been more coherent, and maybe it could have been a full monetary union instead of this halfway house common currency area that we have. It's an incomplete monetary union, if you like, with central bank with incomplete powers and incomplete responsibilities. So maybe it might have worked if fewer people had joined it, but for sure, Italy is really the headache now. There's a new government. It may be less erratic than the one that went before, but Italy is hugely heavily borrowed. It hasn't had any great success in economic policy for decades, even going back before the euro. The trouble is, it's too big to save. It's a different story. Cyprus got into trouble, and you can lend them money. Ireland got into trouble; they lent us money. They created some of the trouble, but no matter. Italy is Italy. Italy has more government bonds in issue than any other country in Europe. And if there's a big run on the Italian bond market, say if there's a bad recession internationally, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it could, and they start dumping Italian bonds, which they've done before, it's not clear that the system has the capacity to deal with that. In other words, there is a cuckoo in the nest. That's okay as long as it's a small cuckoo. But if it's an Italy-sized cuckoo, it is a permanent threat overhanging the euro.
And yet, 20 years on, we see the likes of President Emmanuel Macron of France trying to push it on towards the same kind of status as the dollar would have in the United States, trying to bring in a Eurozone finance minister, a separate Eurozone budget, a common bond that could be used by all member states. Do you think we're ever going to get there?
Well, yeah, except that a reasonable question, Emmanuel, is why didn't you think of that in 1997?
You might have been still in school.
Well, fine, but the folks who pushed us all into this common currency experiment were warned about those things. There were people, it's very interesting to read back on some of this stuff, there were people in the 1990s who said, we better have centralized supervision of banks before we, you know, that would have been a lot of help here. We have it now, but we didn't have it when the banks were going off the rails. There were people in the 1990s who said, you need a bigger federal budget like they have in the United States. The United States is a thoroughgoing monetary union. The dollar zone is a thoroughgoing monetary union. They had a civil war in the 1860s, And we all got taught in school that it was about slavery, and it was. It was also about unhappiness in the South as against the industrial North over the exchange rate and the dollar.
And centralized power versus and state rights.
All this kind of stuff, and what kind of a central bank should we have, or should we have one at all? Those were components in the possible breakup of the dollar zone. Okay, it's 150 years ago, whatever it is. And these common currency areas are fragile. I mean, the ruble zone was a common currency area. So was the Yugoslav dinar zone. I have somewhere at home a 10 million dinar note issued by one of the constituent central banks in Yugoslavia, which was presented to me at the central bank in Zagreb for giving a speech. And I've never made so much money for giving a short speech. So they ended up with a war and a hyperinflation. And that was the, amongst other things, that was the breakup of a currency union. So currency unions are not necessarily permanent. And if Macron succeeds, and if he persuades his colleagues in Germany in particular to go along with this, and I'm not sure they will, then you would have a stable and durable monetary union. But without that, there is the risk of recurring crises.
Let's go back to the euro and Ireland in particular. As you said, the first couple of years after 1999, everything seemed to be going fine. The economies generally were going well. And then we hit the skids. A lot of that, not just in Ireland, but in the likes of Spain as well, was because our economies were growing at a rapid rate. More and more capital from all around Europe, risk-free and currency risk-free, were piling in here. The banks from all over Europe, including Germany, were prepared to lend. But we had no unilateral ability to try to address that.
Well, we did. If we had tough oversight and supervision of the banking system, or sufficiently cautious people managing the banks, then we would not have gone into trouble. It's only fair to point out, too, though, that some countries that were not part of the euro managed to organise banking crises for themselves in those years. But the pattern that you mentioned, say, in connection with Spain, where there is a fast-growing country, it becomes more attractive as a borrower because of the elimination of exchange rate risk. And it blows up its real estate sector and the banks get into trouble and so on. Not merely did that happen in Spain, it happened in Ireland and several other places, including some places outside the Eurozone. But it was explicitly predicted in the 1990s that this was a risk with the euro, and it was blithely ignored. And there were many other prescient people around, more prescient than I was. I'm not saying I foresaw that, in the manner in which it played out, but there were some economists around that did.
It's a rhetorical question now, but do you think Ireland would have survived the banking crisis in better shape if we hadn't been a member of the euro?
Who knows?
Because to be fair to the ECB, while they inverted commas, screwed us in some ways, they did ultimately make capital available to our banks as we started pulling out of it.
Yeah, well, that's what central banks were established in order to do things like that. So you don't get a round of applause if you're a central bank and you stabilise the financial system in a crisis. That historically is the reason why central banks were established in the first place. But on the counterfactual question, what would have happened if we'd stayed out of the euro? I think it's kind of a parlour game to go on about stuff like that at this distance. But I was nervous about Ireland joining the euro. A lot of people thought perhaps we shouldn't, particularly when the Brits decided to stay out. But my tuppenceworth is that we would have probably had a bust anyway outside the euro. Bear in mind that countries that stayed out of the euro managed to screw up. Iceland did, for example, and a few others. So I think we would have had a bubble and a bust, but it probably wouldn't have been as big because of the point you made of the very easy inflows of capital. It became feasible for banks to lose the plot They might have lost the plot a bit anyway, but their capacity to lose the plot would have been constrained had we had an independent currency.
The easy inflows of capital and then the way the providers of those capital were protected by the ECB and others afterwards.
Yeah, indeed.
You mentioned the UK, and there's a lot of documentation recently that the UK actually gave serious consideration to joining the euro at one stage.
Yeah.
They didn't, and you believe perhaps the seeds of the current problem of Brexit may have been partly sown when they didn't.
Yeah, there's been some very interesting kind of memoir speeches given by senior officials in London about what went on during the Cameron government. And it was David Cameron that eventually said, let's have a referendum, which he thought he was going to win, lost, and here we are. And Cameron's own book is coming out in the next couple of weeks. It will be an apologia pro vita sua. But it's clear from what's been revealed that the British decision to stay out was an ingredient in the causation of Brexit. Why is that? There were always four big countries in Europe: Italy, France, Germany, and Britain. Italy kind of ended up being less influential than the other three because of the political instability and mismanagement of the Italian economy and all that. So it was kind of a carriage drawn by three horses of more or less equal size instead of four. And then Germany got to be bigger because East Germany collapsed and Germany suddenly became a quarter, a third bigger than either France or Britain. And then the euro came along. The British, for their own reasons, said we don't want to join that. And you created a renewal of the suspicion that this was a Franco-German project and the British influence was going to be diminished. And it did, I think, feed not so much xenophobia or europhobia or anything like that in Britain. There was always a bit of that. But it fed the willingness of more sober people in Britain to contemplate withdrawal from the European Union.
And perhaps the Euro-German project that not only was heading full steam towards political unity in across the EU, but that would also perhaps undermine the power of the City of London.
Yeah, that was a part of it. And there were specific meetings of the European Council in 2010, 11, 12, around that time, when British concerns about regulatory control in the financial sector were accentuated because the Europeans were saying, well, you know, you're not the euro, we are in the euro, we're going to do it this way. And the survival of the European Union's cohesion was threatened when the British declined to scrap their own currency.
To use that much overused phrase, and here we go again, we are where we are.
Yeah.
20 years on, it has survived. It survived the worst that we could throw at it, the worst that Greece could throw at it. Some of the measures that are needed to provide solidarity to banks and even countries that get into trouble in the future are beginning to emerge. Yeah. We still have the same 12 currencies in there. What? How do you see its future?
Yeah. I actually think there are 19 now because there's a bunch of smaller countries, Estonia and all of these have joined. Not that that makes a huge difference. I think that the euro can survive and will survive with its current arrangements, unless things go really badly in Italy. And if things go really badly in Italy, it is difficult to see that the current architecture has the capacity to deal with that. There have been improvements. For example, there is now centralized bank supervision. So I think what happened here is unlikely to or less likely to happen again. But there are still weak banks in Europe. And the overall performance of the ECB I know it's improved a lot under Mario Draghi, who's going to retire in the next few weeks. But under Trichet, the performance was terrible. They got it wrong. They increased interest rates briefly in the middle of the crisis. They messed countries around. They got into conflict with member state governments. Trichet seemed to believe that as long as you produce a low inflation rate, then financial stability would automatically follow or something like that. So I'm kind of nervous about the longer term viability of a common currency area. And politically, since it was a political project, you have to look back on it and think, maybe if they'd said, this is a bit too risky, we won't do this, we won't have a common currency, we'll wait until there is more political cohesion in Europe before we launch it, maybe Britain would still be in the European Union.
And at best, even if Italy proves not to be an explosive, destructive device in the middle of the project, at best, it is likely still just going to remain a super common currency in a way, because it looks like the momentum towards political unity, yeah, of which it was an advanced feature, yeah, has rolled back.
Yeah, a premature feature, if you know what I mean. There's always been this kind of notion amongst the people who are keenest on a federal Europe to kind of say, well, let's pretend we already have one and push ahead bravely with these different projects, and then the political system will catch up and so on. And I think it's come unstuck on this one.
If I could throw just a completely different question to you just before we finish, Colm. We saw the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK this week, Savid Javid, introducing or saying that there will be duty-free produce at ports and airports in the UK if it crashes out without a deal out of the EU. Yeah. And Ireland immediately responded and said that in that event, we would also have duty-free, yeah, between Ireland and Britain, not, yeah, with the north of Ireland.
Yeah.
Were you surprised at that turn of events?
Well, first of all, he did say that this is only if there's a no-deal crash out. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. Nothing surprises me. You really do have to scratch around to tell the Leave electorate that there is an upside to crashing out. And there is. Booze cruises to France and more cheap fags and vote Tory at the next election. I am certain that the officials in the Treasury said, Minister, you know, that's going to cost us a big heap of revenue, which Boris has been spending on all sorts of stuff in the last few weeks as if there was no tomorrow. I thought it was kind of a desperate move by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I was a little bit surprised that the Irish Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, should have flashed out a press statement, good news press statement, so quickly. It's open to governments, if they want to say, we think that booze and cigarettes are too expensive and we're going to reduce the tax on cigarettes and on booze.
In the normal course of events.
In the normal course of events. But they don't think that. They think that drinking too much and smoking too much is bad for you, I thought.
So you think, from the UK's point of view, it was a populist measure designed to grease the wheels for those who are either committed to the Brexit cause or who have concerns about it. This is part of the sunny uplands. But you were also surprised at how quickly we responded, given that it's going to, you know, in that event, it would be a huge hit to our exchequer as well.
How huge, I'm not sure, because the amount of duty-free cigarettes, I think, is only 200 or one bottle of booze or whatever. An awful lot of traffic between here and Britain, and there's an awful lot of traffic between Britain and continental Europe. So the exchequers would lose money. But don't forget that this would only happen in a no-deal crash-out.
And your views on that?
It's illegal in the UK now. The Parliament, which has been deprorogued, as far as we can make out, passed a law which says that the Prime Minister and Mr. Javid are not allowed to crash the United Kingdom out of the European Union without a deal.
We leave it there. Economist Colin McCarthy, who will be presenting his views on the 20-year history of the euro at the Dublin Economists Workshop this week. Colin, thank you indeed for joining us.
Thanks.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Professor Alan Ahern, Director of the Whitaker Institute and Professor of Economics at NUI Galway. Alan also spent 7 years working in the Fed, advising a number of its chairmen, including Ben Bernanke. Alan, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Vincent.
Now, Alan, we've been talking to fellow economist Colin McCarthy about the challenging 20-year history of the euro and the eurozone to date. And, of course, the European Central Bank, one of the key actors in that ongoing project. Mario Draghi, we saw, he's leaving us, but he has delivered, as expected, another round of quantitative easing, pumping more bond buying and more money into the European economy to try and stimulate it and to try and stimulate some inflation. It's very strange territory and dangerous territories for central banks generally, particularly on both sides of the Atlantic, isn't it?
It is. I mean, what we've seen is that, because if you go back a couple of years, the global economy was really looking quite good. The United States was growing quickly, and even the euro area was showing some signs of life. But in the last year, the data coming in are rather weak, and that really has raised concerns that the euro area may be going back into recession, and there's even some concerns about the United States perhaps slowing. I mean, a lot of it is you can point to policy, slow down the global troubles in the global economy. A lot of them linked to one thing, and that is to Donald Trump's trade policy and the tariff war that he has launched against China. And if it's that uncertainty about trade that is at the core, I think, of the weakness and therefore the core of the concerns about the global economy. There are, of course, other things. I mean, Europe, you have Brexit. But really, a lot of it comes back to the uncertainty about trade and about Donald Trump's trade policies.
It's really posing headaches for central bankers like Mario Draghi and like Jerome Powell, though, because in the eurozone, 2.5 trillion euro of a quantitative easing program over a number of years. And really, it hasn't moved the dial in terms of growth or inflation. And now Mario Draghi basically going back into the toolbox again and interestingly facing very significant opposition from some of the bigger eurozone governors, the France, Germany, Holland. It's uncharted territory.
It is, but you know, central banks, they have a job to do in that they have to get the inflation rate up to whatever their target rate is. And in Europe, the ECB's target for inflation is 2%. And it looked like inflation was moving slowly back up towards that target, but the latest data show it falling back. So central banks, the ECB needs to do more. That's their job. Their job is to hit a certain inflation target, and if they're not going to do that, then they need to do more. Now, they have interest rates on the floor. Interest rates are zero, and some interest rates are actually negative. So there's not a whole lot they can do on the interest rate front. And therefore, they've got to think of other tools. And the other tools is the bond buying tools and some other stuff they're doing in the market. So yes, they have to think outside the box, and they have to do things that they never did before. But that's because we find ourselves in a situation which is unprecedented. What's interesting about Mario Draghi this week is his call for help from governments in terms of fiscal policy. What he's sort of hinting at is that the ECB, yes, they're going to do more. But there's only so much that they can do in order to boost growth and to get the inflation rate up. And what's needed is budgetary and taxation policy to help. That is, the Mario Draghi, and I think he's right on this, wants to see some loosening of fiscal policy, budgetary policy around you, particularly for countries that can afford to do it, that have lots of fiscal space. And there, although he didn't mention it, what he has in mind, and I think what everybody has in mind, is Germany. I mean, Germany has a very strong fiscal position. Interest rates, German government can borrow at negative interest rates, even out 10 and 20 years. I mean, if you can borrow money at a negative interest rate, you can surely invest it, public investment. And even if you get a zero return on that public investment, you're still up on the deal because you're paying negative interest rates on your borrowing. So surely the German government can find big infrastructure and projects that they may be related, for example, with decarbonization agenda. But they should be borrowing more money. They can afford to do it. They have the fiscal space, and that spending into the euro economy would help central banks.
And we've talked on that on this platform recently about the issues involved as to when and whether the Germans might do that, Alan. I suppose the worry is that if governments like Germany's don't move quickly enough, where does the European Central Bank, where do central banks go the next time if there's a big economic shock in the wake of Brexit or if economies continue to decelerate into recession? Where do they go? And this seemed to be the basis of the pushback by the Germans, the French and the Dutch and others this week.
Yeah, I mean, central banks are never completely out of ammunition. They can, and they, after all, they have pushed their ECB's deposit rate into negative territory. That is that banks, if they have excess money, they deposit with the ECB and the ECB is charging them a negative interest on that, they can make that interest rate even more negative. They can always push that direction. They can always buy more bonds, more government bonds. And again, that brings down long-term interest rates and should make it more attractive for governments to borrow and to spend. They can lend even more and cheaper money to banks. Hopefully banks will then lend out more. So they can always push a bit more on the envelope. The problem is at the margins, the benefits from this sort of stuff starts to decline. And therefore, that's why they need governments, or they need policy to work better. And in particular, in Europe, they need more fiscal spending. And they need to put we need globally to put an end to this uncertainty about the trade war and about the trade tensions between China and the US.
Is there a danger, do you think, though, that that this medicine that the central banks are pumping into the body politic, into the body economic, could actually turn to poison? Because, as you say, the more and more you reduce interest rates and use other mechanisms, the marginal benefit is probably slimmer. You may be signalling to key investors and businesses across the economy that we actually think we're on the verge of something negative here. And of course, there's the whole threatening impact on savers.
Yeah, and the savers, I think, is a very important thing because we have very low or negative interest rates in many different countries. And Donald Trump was calling this week for negative interest rates in the United States. Of course, that helps borrowers. We know that interest rates, for example, ECB's main refinancing rate is going to stay at zero for a long time. The markets are pricing in no movement in that rate for 6 years. It means somebody with a tracker mortgage in Ireland is not facing an increase in the interest rates for 6 years if the markets have that right. So for borrowers, very low interest rates are positive, but they're not positive. They're not good for savers or for people who depend on fixed income, depend on returns from bonds, for example. And in many countries, particularly in the United States, there's a lot of people who are retired who depend on those income from fixed income bonds. And they are finding it tough in the sense that their returns have declined. And the other thing is that, so there are side effects, negative side effects from these policies, no doubt about that. Another thing is that because interest rates are low, anybody who's trying to get yield, who's trying to get some sort of return, is being forced to take more and more risk. And we saw this before back in the 2000s. This is the stretching for risk. And of course, that could lead to too much risk taking and financial instability. So there are certainly downsides to all this. Again, that makes it even more important that governments, whether it's through trade policy or through fiscal policy, work hand in hand, or at least push in the same direction or help central banks, that they don't leave it all up to central banks. They can't say, we're going to do bad budgetary policy or bad trade policy, but we're not worried about the economy because the central banks will clean up the mess. That's a dangerous strategy because there are downsides and problems associated with these unconventional monetary policy tools.
for all the problems facing the European Central Bank and the person going in there now, Christine Lagarde, they're not facing outright opposition from their political masters and aggressive messages on Twitter and in the media, as the Bank of England to a slight degree has in the UK because of the Brexit debate, but notoriously so in the United States, where this week Donald Trump referred to the members of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell and all, as boneheads.
It's quite extraordinary. The issue with Donald Trump is that he had promised in the election campaign and since then that the U.S. economy will grow 3%. So economic growth every year 3%. That was a ridiculous promise because the U.S. economy is at full employment. It can't grow 3%. It doesn't have enough labor. It doesn't have the productivity growth. The Federal Reserve estimates that the U.S. economy can grow comfortably around 2-2.25%. If it grows much faster than that for a while, it's going to create inflation because the economy is going to overheat. Remember, unemployment is now at 3.7%. It's the lowest in 50 years. They have full employment. There's a job for anybody who wants them. So they're not going to be able to grow that 3% rate indefinitely. What you're seeing from Trump is frustration that he has made that promise. And he'll say, well, as we come over the next 12 to 18 months and into facing the election, November 2020, he's going to be saying, well, the U.S. economy would have grown 3%. If it wasn't for those boneheads in the Federal Reserve that did bad monetary policy. And of course, the thing about one of the reasons that there's uncertainty about the U.S. economy and growth now is that the main thing is that Donald Trump has created uncertainty with his trade policies. So on one hand, he's given up with the Federal Reserve, but then he himself is doing stuff that has thrown a really dark cloud over the prospects for the U.S. economy and for the global economy.
And that presents a real challenge for Jerome Powell and his colleagues on the Federal Reserve Board, Alan, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, Trump's political policies, his trade policies, has caused greater caution and a slowdown in the U.S. economy. And that has triggered the first interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve in nearly 10 years back in July. And that seems to imply that they are responding to political pressure.
I don't think they are. They certainly they cannot ignore stuff that Donald Trump says. He is the president. But so they are cognizant of what he is saying. And there are risks there, the risks for the Federal Reserve from the particular from individual and from stuff that he's saying. And they're aware of that. All that said, Donald Trump does not set monetary policy, and the Federal Reserve has a statutory obligation to set monetary policy to achieve maximum employment and stable prices, and that's what they will aim at. And so they're hearing what's going on, but they are going to set interest rates and do monetary policy in a way that's sensible, given what's going on in the economy. Now, they were raising interest rates. One of the things that it was difficult to judge was how much damage the trade uncertainty and the trade war with China was going to do to the U.S. economy. And I think what they have done is what they're seeing evidence now, particularly very weak manufacturing in the United States and globally. They're seeing that this trade uncertainty is doing quite a lot of damage. They're seeing very weak investment by businesses. You think about a company. They don't know whether to open up a new plant in China, for example, as part of their global supply chains, or whether they should open a plant in the United States. It all depends on what trade policy is. If the trade war comes to an end, then they should open it up in China. If the trade war escalates, then they need to have that plant in the United States because they won't be able to trade anymore. So the company doesn't know what to do, and therefore they're not investing. And we're seeing that in weakness in investments. So what the Federal Reserve was trying to gauge is how much damage the trade war was doing to the economy. And they had to, they've had to recalibrate that. They now reckon it's doing more damage than they thought, and therefore interest rates were probably too high, and they've nudged them down a bit, and they're probably going to nudge them down again. But they're always looking at the data coming in and trying to see what does that mean for the outlook for the U.S. economy, and therefore what's the most appropriate interest rates. That's what they're watching. They're not going to be told what to do by Donald Trump.
You're pretty sure of that. You've worked at the heart of the Federal Reserve. You know some of these people. You're pretty sure that they have the stomach to stand up to them, are you?
I am. I know how they operate. They gather data every 5 minutes from different parts of the U.S. and global economy. They analyze it. They look at the analysis from 10 different angles. That's what they're doing. They know these are sensitive people. They know that you cannot set interest rates dictated by the political cycle. And so, yes, stuff that's going on with the president is there. It's part of the environment in which they operate. But you cannot let politicians and the president of the U.S. Set interest rates, and they're not going to do that. I'm certain of that. Now, that may, as we approach November 2020, make for even more conflict. And pretty sure Donald Trump is not going to stop twittering. As I said, the U.S. is not going to achieve 3% growth. It shouldn't be growing 3%. That's too fast. So there's going to be more problems. He may try to oust Jay Powell. That's all possibly coming down the track. But the Fed, I'm sure, is focused on doing good monetary policy.
For all the rocks and barbs that Donald Trump is throwing at the Fed, there's a unique symbiosis between them, isn't it? Because if Trump eases back with China, as he seems to be now, on the basis that he recognises he needs a trade deal before the election year, if he eases back and that gives confidence again to businesses and consumers, then the Fed may actually say, we don't need the number of interest rate cuts that you want.
That's right. If the trade uncertainty can be lifted, the U.S. is actually, for all the talk about the dark clouds, the U.S. economy is actually in pretty decent shape. It's growing. Its investment is weak, and their trade is weak. The American consumer is still spending. Consumer spending is strong, and that's the biggest part of the U.S. economy. So there is confidence amongst consumers, and they are spending. If they can resolve the uncertainty over trade and investment picks up, then you will have strong growth in the U.S. And yes, the Federal Reserve will respond to that by then not cutting interest rates. The most appropriate, and if inflation picks up, the most appropriate move would then be another interest rate cut. But it's doing that because the U.S. economy is growing strongly and can take and the higher interest rates, and the appropriate stance of monetary policy would be higher interest rates. If Donald Trump, presumably the most important thing for him is a strongly going U.S. economy, whatever interest rates are going to do what they need to do because the Fed will respond. But the most important thing for him politically, I would imagine, is a fast growing U.S. economy. He can then boast about that and all the jobs being created and the lowest unemployment in 50 years. And therefore, he really politically does need to come to some sort of deal with China.
And the other dynamic in all of this, I suppose, is the currency situation and the fact that central banks are being blamed for currency manipulation. In fact, Mario Draghi had to come out yesterday aggressively back to Donald Trump, and it's bizarre that these direct communications are swinging across the Atlantic, and Trump basically saying that the ECB had brought down interest rates further to weaken the euro so as to boost European trade, and Draghi coming back directly saying, we have a mandate, we pursue price stability, we don't target exchange rates, period. It's bizarre.
Yeah, Mario Draghi is right. Central banks affect the economy largely through interest rates, and those interest rates then affect investment and consumer spending. Of course, there is some effect on the exchange rate, but I think you have to remember that the U.S., for example, is largely a closed economy. I mean, trade is exports and imports are a very small part of the U.S. economy. It's largely the biggest component of spending in the U.S. is consumer spending, And investment is also very important. Similarly, if you take the euro area as a whole, it's domestic demand, it's consumer spending and investment that really drives growth rather than trade. So the exchange rate, I'm not saying the exchange rate is not important. It is a channel through which monetary policy works, but it's not by far, but it's not the most important important channel. So all the stuff about exchange rates is largely a red herring. What central banks are trying to do is not, they're not trying to affect exchange rates. They're trying to affect domestic demand. They're trying to affect consumer spending investment. That's true in the euro area, and that is also true in the United States. And central banks have no role in exchange rates. Yes, when they do things, when they change interest rates, you will see some effect on exchange rates, but that's not the reason they're changing interest rates. The exchange rate policy is the responsibility of governments. So it's a responsibility of governments in Europe and the European Commission, and it's a responsibility of the U.S. Treasury, not of the Federal Reserve or the ECB.
If you're a betting man, do you think he'll come to an agreement with China late this year and we'll all avoid recession?
I certainly hope so, but I can't get into the mind of Donald Trump. I mean, the economics of it is clear. You can see the damage that he is doing to the global economy. But the politics of it is that he likes to be seen to take on China, and he is fulfilling some of the promises he made in his election campaign. And he is appealing to a certain base that feel that their incomes or jobs have been threatened by imports, particularly from China. So he's going to take all that political consideration. So this is a case where politics is trumping over economics. And I hope for everybody's sake that situation changes soon.
Beautifully put. Politics trumping over economics. We leave it there. That was Professor Alan Ahern, Director of the Whitaker Institute and Professor of Economics at NUI Galway. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Vincent.
Taking Stock on Newstalk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Michael Stott, Latin America editor for the Financial Times. Michael, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Michael, it's groundhog time again in Argentina, once one of the world's richest economies, but teetering perhaps on the verge of a ninth sovereign default of its debts, and a political crisis triggered this time by a shock primary election result back in August.
That's right, Vincent. It's really sad to see Argentina again in the same place that it's been so many times before, unable to pay its debts, its economy in crisis. And this time, unusually, as the result not of very bad government policies, but as the result of a shock election.
And why was that a shock? Because the incumbent president, Mauricio Macri, had come to power nearly 4 years ago on a business economy reforming platform.
That's right, he had, Vincent, and investors and business were very happy with him initially. They felt he was following all the right policies. But to some extent, he was unlucky. He faced a very bad drought last year, which affected very severely Argentina's agricultural exports, on which the country relies. And he was also reluctant to impose too much austerity too quickly, worried about the consequences of that at the polls. And the results of those two things were that the country ended up having to borrow a lot of money in dollars. And that hurt its budget and its current account. Investors started to lose confidence. And he had to go to the IMF last year and borrow a lot of money. That kept him afloat until this year. But in the meantime, the austerity imposed by the IMF meant that the economy started to lurch into recession. And he was punished for that in August at the primary when he was defeated by a 16-point margin by his opponent, Alberto Fernandez, of the leftist Peronist Party. And that result gave investors a big fright because they remember when Mr. Fernandez and his colleagues were in power last before Mr. Macri, and the results were not happy ones for investors or business.
Given that Mr. Macri's policies weren't working as well as they could have and were inflicting pain and did lead to, I think, 3 years of recession during his four-year term to date. Given that context, given that he had to go to the IMF, which understandably, I presume, isn't that popular in Argentina, and given the fact that the Peronist Party, which beat him in the election in August, has been in power for most of the last 70 years in Argentina, why was it such a shock to the markets?
That's a very good question. I think part of the answer, Vincent, is that the opinion polls almost universally in Argentina were signaling a pretty tight race for the primary. So it was above all a shock about expectations. The opinion polls were suggesting that there might be at most a few points separating the two candidates. And in fact, Mr. Macri's camp had been putting the word around beforehand that you know, they might even be equal or even slightly ahead. So there was a huge shock when the result came through, and it was so different to what had been expected. That on the one hand. And then on the other, I think, you know, investors and business people were, if you like, it was a case of wishful thinking that they wanted to believe that these policies that they thought made sense would also make sense to the Argentine people. But of course, if you're in downtown Buenos Aires and you've had your bus subsidies cut and inflation is pushing prices up 50% a month, your wages are not keeping pace, and unemployment is rising, you're going to look around and say, actually, things were maybe better for me with the Peronists than they are now.
That election in August was only a primary round. The real election doesn't take place till late October, but it signals that the Peronists are almost certainly likely to come back. And there was a huge shock in the market. I mean, the peso fell to record weak levels against the dollar. The stock market, I think, had the second sharpest fall of any Western stock market in nearly 150 years.
That's correct. Yeah, it was an enormous shock to the market. It's because that margin of victory of the Peronists was so big in the primary. And because the primary is a compulsory vote and it's a vote that happens nationwide, it's regarded as a very reliable indicator, much more reliable than the polls, of what will happen in the real election at the end of October. And in that election, there's a possibility of winning in the first round if you get more than 45% of all the votes, or you get 40% of all the votes with a 10-point lead. And of course, since the lead for Mr. Fernandez was 16 points, he looks highly likely to win on the first round at the end of October.
Now, one of the real concerns amongst some of the population in Argentina, I presume, certainly with the IMF and international markets and creditors of Argentina, is that Mr. Fernandez's vice running mate, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, was president for 8 years, a Peronist herself, that she may really be in charge if they get back. And she effectively completely mismanaged the economy during her 8-year term and is in fact facing trial for alleged corruption offences.
That's exactly right. She made what's now regarded as rather a clever move earlier in the year, and she was widely expected to run in her own right for president, but she chose to make Mr. Fernandez, who's not a relation, but he is a former cabinet chief, both for her and her husband, who preceded her in the job, to make him the candidate for president, and she would run as the vice president. And the effect that had was that her supporters would still continue to vote for her because she was on the ticket, but people who didn't like her, and she did have a lot of opponents and enemies because of not least the corruption and the economic mismanagement, her opponents could draw comfort from the fact that she wasn't actually the presidential candidate. So it managed to neutralize that effect. So, yes, there's real concern around her return, and she has been pretty quiet since the primary election result. She's been keeping out of the limelight, leaving Mr. Fernandez, Alberto Fernandez, to do most of the talking. Her daughter is very unwell. Her daughter is in Havana having medical treatment, and she's tried to put around the idea that because she's got family issues to deal with, she won't have much time or much inclination to get involved in government. But there are a lot of people who don't believe that, who think that she will be the power behind the throne. She still has a huge following in the Peronist Party. She's still popular with a lot of ordinary Argentines. And so there is also a feeling that in fact, she will be a power behind the throne in an Alberto Fernandez government.
Why, Michael, if Peronist governments, particularly the crew that are likely to come to power again in October, effectively throw money at problems, nationalize industries, subsidize areas that perhaps don't require subsidy, why in that scenario, which is only likely to increase hyperinflation and keep the pesos weak against the dollar, do particularly centre-ground Argentinians vote for them?
Well, Vincent, yes, that one might well ask myself that question. I mean, it's really the sort of the phenomenon of populism again. So what happens typically in Argentina, the cycle keeps playing out again and again. As a Peronist government's elected, it starts to splurge money. There's a temporary short-term boom. The economy is lifted a bit. People's wages improve. Their standard of living improves. Things look better. And then, of course, they run out of money because they borrow too much. Inflation takes off and it all ends in tears. And they then elect a reformist opposition government. The opposition government comes to power. But, of course, by then the economy is in a total mess. There's no money. They've overborrowed. Inflation's rocketed. And so the opposition then has to impose austerity, cut spending, cut subsidies, try to bring down inflation. And they do this. And this causes more pain, more grief. And so, of course, then by the end of that opposition term, people think back to the Peronists and say, oh, actually, things were better with them. You know, we had a better life. We had more money. And so they vote Peronist again. And the whole cycle starts again. And that cycle, unfortunately, in Argentina has repeated itself again and again and again and again in the last 70 years. And it looks like it's about to happen once more.
And is the population of Argentina a particularly fickle lot? Because, as you say, Groundhog Day, they do bring in reformist governments again after a certain amount of inflationary activity. But I gather no Peronist president has actually completed his or her fourth-year term over the last 70 years. And in fact, one of them had to escape by helicopter from rioting mobs back in, was it 2001 or two?
Yes, no non-Peronist president has managed to complete the term. That's right, yes. And we did have one, Fernando de la Rúa, who was president in 2001 when there was a very severe crisis which triggered rioting in the streets. He was airlifted from the roof of the presidential palace by helicopter during this crisis, and there were several people killed in the riots. It was a very, very severe crisis. It led to what was at the time the worst default in history, when Argentina defaulted not only on its domestic and international creditors, but also on the IMF, which is pretty rare. So what people are hoping fervently, Vincent, is that this will not be a repeat of that crisis. It will not end up quite so badly this time.
Hopefully not. Now, Mauricio Macri hasn't given up on still winning the election in late October. He's, I think, an engineer by background from a very wealthy Italian family originally. But he has had to introduce measures, and he has had to signal strongly that the government's overseas debt, I think 80% of $100 billion, about $80 billion of overseas debt to bondholders and the IMF, is going to have to be deferred.
That's right, yes. I mean, Argentina simply can't afford to pay its debts again. So he's ended up reluctantly, but he's been forced by this crisis over the past weeks to adopt many of the measures that the Peronists adopted in the past, things like debt restructuring, price freezes, controls on how much foreign exchange, how many dollars you can buy, in order to try to stem the bleeding in the economy and to conserve some of Argentina's reserves. So that's ended up making him look very bad, because one of the first things he did on taking office was to scrap all these controls and restrictions that the Peronists had put in place before he started. And he's now having to put them back himself. This is, of course, exactly what the Peronists want him to do. They want him to be humiliated. And that's making the crisis worse, because we have this limbo now. The primary result, you know, cut the legs from under Macri, made him look like a complete lame duck. But the actual vote, as you pointed out, Vincent, is not until the end of October. So we've got this agonizing period where Macri is a lame duck, but the Peronists are not prepared to accept any responsibility because they haven't been elected. And Mr. Fernandez is playing that for all it's worth. He recently went off to Madrid for a week to do some teaching at a university there. But in the meantime, he keeps throwing out these little comments about how Macri has ruined the country and things are so bad and it's all Macri's fault and the IMF's fault and they're going to have to clear up the mess that they created. And that's absolutely not what investors and business people want to hear. They'd love to see Mr. Fernandez and Mr. Macri sitting down together and agreeing jointly some measures that might relieve the pain in the Argentine economy and put markets back in order, put the ship back on track. But of course, Mr. Fernandez has no interest in helping a man who's running against him. And so the dynamics of the electoral contest here are working against everybody and making it very difficult for Argentina to stabilize before that October 27 election.
Before we get to the implications for Argentina and indeed for the wider South American economy, Michael, of what might happen either side of that October election, can I ask you, what is it about Argentina? Because on the face of it, it should be one of the more prosperous countries on the planet. It's got very fertile land and lots of it, lots of mineral resources. It's not overpopulated, 44 million people. Are there structural imbalances within the economy, extremes of wealth? Is it heavily unionized? What is it about it that keeps this nightmare going?
Yes, there's a number of persistent economic ills, Vincent. One is that it's a country heavily reliant on commodity exports. It's been unable to diversify its economy successfully. Domestic industry is heavily protected and quite inefficient. I mean, those are things that have not changed in many years. It's a strongly unionized country as well, so labor costs are quite high and there are quite a lot of inefficiencies in the market. And those fundamental problems have been there all along. And then they've been exacerbated by what you referred to earlier, a very fickle electorate, which is sort of unable to see beyond the next year or two and has a very short memory and keeps tending to vote back these populist governments who just open the spending taps and run up debts that they can't pay. So I think that's really the reason why Argentina keeps falling into the same trap. If you look next door in Chile, you have almost the opposite extreme. You have a government that's managed the economy generally very prudently, very conservatively, very effectively, and largely avoided all these boom and bust cycles and crises that Argentina has fallen into. And Chile, in many ways, points to what Argentina ought to be if it could get out of this cycle. But that very fickle electorate tends to get in the way.
Perhaps there's different water systems or services on each side of the Andes, Michael. But this latest crisis, it poses a real dilemma for the IMF. Now, it granted a record bailout. I think it's 21st bailout for Argentina last year under Christine Lagarde, $57 billion. And it's now looking at the prospect of at least a delay in getting that back and perhaps another default.
Yes, that's right, Vincent. I mean, the IMF are in a really horrible situation. They gave this record bailout of $57 billion last year because they felt that Macri's policies essentially were correct. He was doing the right thing and they wanted to support him. I mean, that is what the IMF is there for. But they're now faced with a situation where less than a year later, the program has gone off track and they are finding it very difficult to negotiate with Mr. Macri, because of course he's not going to be, almost certainly not going to be in power beyond December the 10th when the handover happens. But they equally can't talk to Mr. Fernandez because at the moment he's just a candidate running for office and he hasn't been elected. So they're in this situation where they're damned if they talk to Mr. Macri and they're damned if they talk to Mr. Fernandez. But in the meantime, they have to make a decision this month on whether to give an additional $5.7 billion of the bailout, which is due for payment before the end of the month and which the government needs in order to keep paying its debts. So they have it again, an excruciating dilemma. Do they throw more good money after bad, or do they withhold the money and maybe be accused of making a political judgment of undermining Mr. Macri further and handing a boost to Mr. Fernandez? Or do they give the money to Mr. Macri and risk that Mr. Fernandez will then get into office and default on the whole thing? I mean, they face a very, very difficult decision. And all they've said so far is just that they want to continue to stand by Argentina and they're evaluating the situation. But they haven't really given a clue as to whether or not they're going to hand over that money this month.
And one of the reasons that it's alleged that the IMF did provide such a large fund last year, to the surprise of many within the IMF as well, I think, is the relationship between Mr. Macri and President Trump in the United States. I think their fathers were certainly business associates, and Trump and his administration has been a strong supporter of the current president in Argentina.
That's right. Yes. Macri's father, Marco, did a big property deal with Trump in New York. He sold him some land, some very valuable land on the West Side for development, and they became friends as a result, and the families knew each other, which is something Trump himself has referred to. So that certainly helped to oil the wheels for Mr. Macri to secure this record bailout last year. But it's also interesting that Mr. Trump has been noticeably quiet in the last few weeks since the primary election. Hasn't had an awful lot to say about his friend down in Buenos Aires. So we'll have to see how that develops.
Assuming the worst, Michael, after the election, that the Peronists don't manage the economy and perhaps we look at some sort of other default and continued spiraling inflation and weakening of the peso in the coming months, is that of concern for the South American continent in general? Brazil is teetering on the edge of recession, and some of the other, I suppose, business-focused administrations, you mentioned Chile, the likes of Ecuador and Colombia, not in the strongest of positions either.
That's right. Brazil, I think, is the main country affected, because most of the trade regionally is between Brazil and Argentina. And Brazil has a far-right government, which has lost no time in slating Mr. Fernandes and talking about how dreadful it would be if he came back to power. They've used very extreme language, even said there might be another Venezuela-type situation in Argentina, and they don't want refugees fleeing over the border to Brazil. So you can imagine how that's inflamed passions in Argentina. And of course, it's also completely burnt the bridges between the two countries if Mr. Fernandes does win. There will also be an impact on a trade agreement, because Brazil and Argentina are members of a regional trade group called Mercosur. And this group had just negotiated, after 20 years of trying, a big free trade deal with the European Union. Now, the Peronists are not at all keen on free trade, and they have already said that if they get into power, they are unlikely to ratify this. Brazil has then said, if this happens, they will pull out and the whole thing will collapse. So there are some quite serious implications for the region and even the European Union of the Peronists winning.
Without being glib about it, certain Irish beef farmers may be supporting the Peronists in next month's elections. You've been a close observer, Michael. What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's, you know, inevitable that Mr. Fernandes will win at the end of October, probably on the first round, and you will see a shift back to the sort of more populist policies of the past. And what that will mean is Argentina becomes a more closed economy again. Its access to international markets for financing will be cut off. It will need then to rely more on its own exports and its own industries, and it will turn back in on itself as it's done various times in its past.
And perhaps a ninth sovereign default on debt and bondholders looking at empty wallets again?
Very much so. Yes, I think it's highly likely. If you look at the prices of the debt at the moment, Vincent, they're trading at around 40, 45 cents a dollar, indicating that markets are expecting a pretty severe haircut.
Don't cry for me. It's a sad story in many ways, but a wonderful country. Michael Stott, thanks for joining us. Michael Stott, Latin America editor for the Financial Times. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent. Pleasure.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our six AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.